So we're in week two of this four-part series that is really trying to lay the foundations for our understanding of the four Gospels, their connection to each other, and the way that we read them and pray them in the liturgy. So last week we saw that there is in nature, in spirituality, in world religions, and of course within our own faith, all these different experiences of four seasons, four compass points, four stages of life, four parts of every great story, the four loves, the four seasonal clusters that we celebrate during our liturgical year, the four colors of the liturgy that we have in our new logo, the four cardinal virtues, the marks of the church, the Marian dogmas. I forgot to mention this, even though I am vocations director, the four vocations, all the states of life, so priesthood and religious, marriage and single lay life, the four transcendentals, but of course, the four Gospels. Now, strap yourselves down, because in the next 10 minutes, I will really take you through what you might do if you did an undergraduate course in the introduction to the Gospels, and you'd spend the whole semester doing this, and we're going to try and do it in the next 10 minutes. So be prepared to be bamboozled, perhaps. So we notice that the first three of the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, are quite similar in their language, in their style, their structure. If you look at particular passages, they're often found equal or it's very similar across the three Gospels. The Gospel of John is clearly very different from all of this. So, for example, if we look at a particular passage, this which has kind of led us to this question, well, how are these Gospels connected and related? We call them the synoptic Gospels because you can look at a particular passage across the three different Gospels. So syn means together, and optic, of course, is to look at or to view. And so we call them the synoptic Gospels because you're able to see them all together. But that leads to the question, well, how are they connected? How are they, in fact, related? So if we jump to the next slide, we'll see, for example, this passage of the healing of a leper. So we see it in the Gospel of Matthew in chapter 8, the Gospel of Mark in chapter 1, and the Gospel of Luke in chapter 5. But you see that the structure is quite similar, but there's differences, obviously, in the way that they tell the particular story. So, for example, Mark's Gospel there in the middle has a whole lot of detail that Matthew's Gospel kind of skims over, but Matthew then adds a longer introduction to this passage. The next slide then leads to what is considered this question, or how do we actually connect and relate the three Gospels? We know that the Gospel of Matthew is always read first, it's always presented in our Bibles first, and that's perhaps because it was considered to be the first of the Gospels to be written. So this is the classic solution that was proposed first by St. Augustine. That Matthew, if it's written first, then Mark's Gospel simply draws from the example and the stories that have already been told in the Gospel of Matthew. And then Luke's Gospel draws from both Mark and from Matthew. So the lines indicate, or the arrows indicate, the sense of movement, that one Gospel is influenced or sourced from another. And moving down the slide, down the screen, we move also through history. So Matthew is the first, then Mark, then Luke. That was the understanding through basically the first 19 centuries of the church, that this was the traditional ordering and the reason that we had the Gospel of Matthew first. But questions began to be asked about this. If Matthew is the first Gospel to be written, it's 28 chapters long. But Mark's Gospel is only 16 chapters. So why would Mark, when he's writing his Gospel, if he already has Matthew's Gospel, why would he leave out some of the stories that are told? And in fact, as we saw on that previous slide, when Matthew tells the story, it's often shorter than Mark's version. So it just didn't seem to make sense. And so then if we jump to the next slide, we'll see that German scholars then began to ponder about this and to try and work out, well, were there other sources that we don't any longer have access to? And so they proposed the two-document hypothesis. So basically, they say, well, Mark is most likely the first gospel to be written. But perhaps there was another source, because there are lots of parts of Mark's gospel that are not in Matthew or in Luke. Things that Matthew and Luke draw from that they didn't seem to get from the gospel of Mark. So they propose this collection of stories about Jesus, particularly the parables that Jesus told. Depending on how you number the parables, there are around 40 different parables, but no one of the Gospels will tell you each of the 40 parables. So they propose this Q source, it's called. Q standing for the German word Quell, meaning source. And so this Q source is available to Matthew and to Luke to flesh out their stories. That's why they tell more parables than are present in the Gospel of Mark. Mark is basically telling you the narrative, just the different parts of the actual encounters, the miracles, the things that Jesus did, and not so many of the parables, not so much of the details about the teaching of Jesus. But there are things that are in Matthew's gospel that aren't in Mark, that aren't in Luke, that don't seem to have come from this Q source, and so they postulate, well, perhaps he had access to other information. Of course, Matthew traditionally has been presumed to have been one of the apostles himself. So, of course, he would have access to other stories through personal experience. Luke is often considered to have access to the Blessed Mother, that he has spoken to Mary, and so that's why he has the details, for example, about the infancy stories in the first two chapters of the Gospel of Luke that are absolutely unique to him. And so they're not present. And so that's why you have the M source for Matthew's additional material, the L source for Luke's additional material, and that's the spaghetti mess that we end up with as this description, this attempt to explain why we have the Gospels the way that they are. But that's only part of the story. The next part is looking historically at the way that the different Gospels were composed and the background stories of each of the Gospels. So, of course, we begin not with the birth of Jesus, but with the death, the passion, and the resurrection of Jesus that we think happened at the end of April in the year 30. That was when the Jewish feast of Passover happened in that particular year. It's the only year where all of those events line up in the best possible way. So we normally date those events to the year 30. And then, of course, around the year 34, then St. Paul, the namesake of our church, has his moment of conversion, that moment of awakening to the power and presence of Jesus. He goes off into the wilderness, we're told, in his biographical section in the letter to the Galatians for some time. And then finally he begins to do his ministry and to go wandering around, forming communities, writing to communities. So over a 15-year period, from 49 to 64, he compiles and writes those 13 letters that form his corpus, his works within the New Testament. Then another significant event is that the temple that we hear has begun about 15 years before the birth of Jesus has finally been finished there in the year 50. And the Gospel of John, which was for many years considered not historical, but when you look at the Gospel of John, it's actually John's Gospel that provides a lot of the detail about the structure and life and ministry of Jesus and provides all of the datable moments. And so one of those is that we're told only in the Gospel of John that the temple is already being rebuilt at that stage for 46 years. So by 50, 20 years later, it's 66 years in total that the temple is being rebuilt, reestablished, and made just a magnificent building. But then, of course, things begin to fall apart. We move to Rome in the mid-60s. So Nero is the emperor at that time. In the summer of 64, there's a massive fire in Rome. Nero finds it very convenient to be able to blame someone other than blaming himself. Who gets the blame? This new group, the new kids in the block, who are the Christians, the Christian community who are present there in the city of Rome. And so they get the blame, and a persecution, a systematic persecution by the Roman soldiers begins of the Christian communities. As part of that, both St. Peter and St. Paul are caught up. They're executed as part of that persecution. So again, in that period of 64 to 65. we think that that's the impetus for the first time that a gospel is written. Mark, of course, has been a companion of both Peter and Paul on his missionary journeys. He's a relation of St. Barnabas, but he's there as part of this group. Perhaps he was there in the ministry of Jesus. There's a story in the Gospel of Mark about a young man during the Passion narratives, and he runs away naked. It's only found in the Gospel of Mark, so we often presume that perhaps that's a biographical mention to Mark himself. So perhaps it's that impetus. Oh my gosh, the world is falling apart. Everyone, all of my friends are being executed. They're being persecuted. They're being tortured. I don't know whether I will be next. Look, it's not good enough just to have the stories about Jesus just told verbally as part of our verbal remembrance. We need to sit down and write these stories down so that if I'm killed, if all of the apostles are killed, there's somebody that is able to have these memories carried on and passed over to the next generation. And so around that same period, and it seems to have been written fairly quickly, that's why it's brief, there's this sense of urgency, immediacy. One of the favorite words that Mark has, particularly in the opening parts of his gospel, is this sense, and then Jesus did this, the sense of immediacy and urgency that is present in the gospel, because he has this sense, everything is going to rubbish, and we need to write this gospel down as quickly as possible. The next screen shows us then the formation of the Gospel of Matthew. The next significant event in the history of Judaism and Christianity is the beginning of this revolution, this revolt against the Romans. It begins in the summer of 66 CE. It's the first of the Jewish wars. And so they begin this fight, this struggle. And for a while, the Jews were having the upper hand. But in 69, the Romans say, look, we can't, this is enough. We need to move against the Jewish people. And so they begin a siege of the city of Jerusalem that ends a year later with, as we've seen, so many of the occupants of the people of Jerusalem dead through starvation, through infighting, and finally through the Roman armies conquering of the city. So August 70, the city of Jerusalem falls. The temple is destroyed. Not a stone is left standing on one another. Everything that is central in the life and ministry of the Jewish people is caught up in the temple. So many of the priests, so many of the rabbis are killed. Many manage to escape and flee into the wilderness. But the whole sense of everything that they've understood, the way that they are, is destroyed in that moment. So it's in the wake of that that the Gospel of Matthew is written. Mark is writing to a Christian community, a Gentile community. But Matthew is writing to these people who have been through hell. And he wants them to understand that Jesus is this point of continuity, that Jesus is the new Moses. And so this image of the mountain that we'll see over the next couple of weeks forms the basis of so much of Matthew's gospel. It's written at the capital city of Christianity at that time, the city of Antioch in Syria, called the Great Antioch to distinguish it from the other Antioch, the Antioch in Pisidia. We know from the Acts of the Apostles that Paul bases himself often in Antioch. It becomes the capital city of Christianity. Jerusalem's destroyed. Rome is just a hotbed of persecution. You can't go there. So Antioch, Great Antioch in the Orontes, which is the river that runs through the middle of the city of Antioch. And so it's there that the Gospel of Matthew is written. Fast forward. As a result of the destruction of Jerusalem, another thing that begins to happen is a persecution of Christians now by the Jewish people. They begin to try and make sense of how are we going to be Jewish now that our city, our temple, everything has been destroyed. And so they see that this Christian sect, this Jewish sect, is beginning to be a threat to their whole way of existence. So an additional benediction is added to the synagogue service, the 18th benediction. And a Christian is unable to say this 18th benediction because it denounces the name of Jesus. It denounces him as being the Messiah. And so there is this increasing movement towards a separation between the Christians and the Jewish people. So that begins in the 80s. At the same time, the Christians are beginning to spread into other parts of the world. And so when Luke sits down to write his story, and of course it's the double story, not just the gospel, but also what we call the Acts of the Apostles or the Acts of King Jesus part two, it's this whole sense of a continuous story providing encouragement to Christians who are struggling, who are being persecuted, but calling them to grow as disciples, calling them to grow in their life of virtue, providing encouragement to them across those centuries. And then the final kind of moment in this is what we, again, it's difficult. There's not a whole lot of records because of everything that was happening. Around the year 90, there was this council of the rabbis in this little village called Yamnia. So it's called the Council of Yamnia. And it's there that Judaism begins to kind of reassess and to finalize how to live in a world without the temple. Because the whole of Judaism before that is about the sacrifices that are offered in the temple. How do we move from that? We focus on the Torah. We focus on the Word of God. And so this beginning of the reading cycle of the Torah comes to the very center and the heart of Judaism. And that's the beginning of what we now know as rabbinical Judaism, where the rabbi becomes central in that whole kind of movement. The final slide, we know that around this time, it's the Gospel of John that is being composed. Unfortunately, because there is this kind of animosity between the Christian community and the Jewish community, one of the unfortunate characteristics of the Gospel of John is this very strong polemic against the Jewish people. In the other Gospels, it's against the Jewish leaders, but in the Gospel of John, it's broadened into the whole community, and we've suffered and struggled as a result of that. But one of the things that we see also around this time, within Judaism, they're beginning to read the Torah on a weekly cycle over a three-year period. And of course, that then becomes the basis for the Christians also doing the same. So what we do now of reading the Gospels over this three-year cycle has already been there from the very first century of the church, but unfortunately it was lost over most of the history of the church. So we'll be looking at that in more detail, and again, how those four Gospels are connected and related, how they fit in with the pattern of life and flow, and of course, how they feature in a new logo. So we continue next week.